have Ravi Zacharias from Let My People Think, speaking on the four stages in the decline of a nation.
And I think what God is saying to Israel is, did you know who you were? And I look at America today, and I wish I could have just a 30-second look at some of the men who are betraying the trust, some of the women who are betraying the trust, and say to them, do you know who you are as a nation?
The nation of Israel claims a status that no other people can. They are God's chosen people. And yet they have one of the most turbulent histories. How did God's own people end up as a nation in exile?
Jeremiah chapter 2, nearly 1,000 years after the Exodus, the nation is on the eve of collapse. And the weeping prophet, the tender-hearted Jeremiah, finds it his responsibility to tell the nation that this beloved city of Jerusalem is going to be denuded. That city which was engraved on his hands and whose walls are ever before me, says the Lord, is now going to be trampled underfoot by the enemy. And Jeremiah has to break that news. Let us read some scattered verses from chapter 2. Look at the words of love and the romantic overtones again. Verse 2 of chapter 2, go and proclaim in the hearing of Jerusalem, I remember the devotion of your youth, how as a bride you loved me and followed me through the desert, through a land not sown. Israel was holy to the Lord, the first fruits of his harvest. All who devoured her were held guilty, and disaster overtook them, declares the Lord. Look at verse 5. This is what the Lord says. What fault did your fathers find in me that they strayed so far from me? They followed worthless idols and became worthless themselves. They did not ask, where is the Lord who brought us up out of Egypt and led us through the barren wilderness? Look at the latter part of verse 7. The priests did not ask, where is the Lord? Those who deal with the law did not know me. The leaders rebelled against me. The prophets prophesied by Baal and followed worthless idols. There's a pungency to it. God is speaking with a broken heart there. When you look at the nation of Israel, you learn a lot about God's heart, what he has envisioned when he is fashioning a nation. You will recall when they cried out for a king, God said, I wish you wouldn't ask me for a king because I wanted to be your king. But I strongly believe, and I want you to understand what I'm trying to say when I say this, if you desire to do something passionately enough and you're determined to go in that direction, God will step aside and second your motion. If you are determined in going in a certain direction, God will step aside and second your motion. So Israel said, look, we want to be a king. We want to be like the other nations around us. God said, but you were holy to me. You were separate. You were chosen. I did not want you to be like other nations. I wanted to be your leader. But if this is what you want, all right, I will find you a man. And he looked and found Saul, who was to be that first king. And he himself went as a reluctant person, dragged into leading that kingdom, like C.S. Lewis's conversion, dragged into the kingdom, kicking and screaming, the most reluctant convert in all of England. Saul was the most reluctant king in all of Israel. But I want you to understand what God did with them. Please follow now. These words are very pivotal. They are borrowed from Eugene Peterson, who has a marvelous way of encapsulating Israel's history. He says this, listen, their salvation was accomplished at the Exodus. Their identity was defined at Sinai, and their preservation was guaranteed through the 40-year wandering in the wilderness. So let me restate that for you. Their salvation was accomplished at the Exodus. Their identity was defined at Sinai, and their preservation was guaranteed through the 40-year wandering in the wilderness. They were therefore a redeemed people, a commanded people, and a blessed people. They were a redeemed people, a commanded people, and a blessed people. And it always must come in that order. You and I can never be good until we are first redeemed. God did not come into this world to make bad people good. He came into this world, says Christ, to make dead people live. So we are first redeemed before we are righteous. He brought them out of Egypt, then gave them the Ten Commandments, then told them how to conduct their worship. Redemption, righteousness, and worship. You can never alter that sequence. You can never be righteous until you are redeemed, and you cannot worship until you are redeemed and righteous. For who shall ascend unto the hill of the Lord but he that hath clean hands and a pure heart? So in that sequence, he redeemed them, identified them, and blessed them. And now after 1,000 years of trying to deal with them, they were turning their backs on him. Do you realize, at the most, if they had gone on the shortest route from where they were in Egypt to the promised land, it is 150 miles, maximum a month, or even stretch it into 2 months, but it took them 40 years. And God tells them why it took them 40 years. He says, I took you through the longer route because I wanted to humble you and teach you that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Ladies and gentlemen, the shortest route is not always the best route, you know. He took them that long route so that they would learn something about him. He had that appointment at Sinai that he wanted them to keep. Now, around the late 500s before Christ, as the nation is pulling down its shutters and the curtain is being drawn on that segment of history, he tells them the process through which the betrayal began. First of all, I bring to you in four stages what happened. First, he says there were ancestral disappointments. What fault did your fathers find in me? There were ancestral disappointments. Do you notice what God touches as the nerve of the problem? He doesn't go to the king. He doesn't go to the hierarchy. He goes to the home and he says, your fathers betrayed me right from the beginning. I was talking to my wife this morning and frankly found myself with my mind wandering through some of the earlier part of this sermon because my oldest girl just made a very, very difficult decision, a good one, that she made yesterday in her life. And when I called last night, she said, I wanted to tell Daddy about it, but I didn't want to weigh him down while he's speaking. And it's been a tough decision, a right decision, a decision that had to be made, but it brought many tears to her. Margie says, it's tough, isn't it, as you're away. And now I happen to be leaving this morning to join you in a week where maybe I really need to be by her side. It's tough. And it doesn't come easy. But one of the things you try to do in your home, I'm sure, as I try to do in mine in the battle, is to try to give our children an identity. Who we are is very important to them. We assume that what we are in our belongings and in our credentials is very important to them, maybe important to them, but of primary importance to those children is who we are. Who is my dad? Not when he's behind the pulpit, but when I see him right here at home. Who is he? What is he made of? And you see, it is intriguing to me that in this infinite mind of God, where so much truth is available, unlimited, and he is restricted by the analogies that you and I can relate to. What I've just said is important. He is restricted by the analogies that you and I can relate to. And you talk to anybody who's been betrayed by his parents, he knows the analogy very well. And God is saying to them, what fault did your fathers find in me? And if you can't relate to that, when you were young, I took you as my bride. I walked with you through a land unsown, and I gave you a beautiful land. Ask a bride who's been betrayed, and she understands what this means. Ancestral disappointments. Some years ago, America was caught up, and rightly so, in an outstanding book written by Arthur Miller. It was called The Death of a Salesman. You may remember reading it even in your school. It's a magnificent play. And by the way, you know, in the ancient times, philosophy was read at the highest levels of abstractions, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, which became quite boring in our times. So we read philosophy in a different way. We read philosophy at the level of the arts. The contemporary philosophers are the artists. And I think Dostoevsky was the one years ago, he said, art is to draw its inspiration from life. He said, but I'm afraid what will stop happening is rather than art imitating life, life will start imitating art, and then life will draw its reasons for existence from the arts. And so Arthur Miller's play became quite reflective and now almost being emulated. It's the story of a salesman called Willie Loman who lived a lie from beginning to end, only his children didn't know it, his wife did. He pretended to be what he was not. He was struggling financially, wasn't making the sales, but bringing home borrowed money that was told to the children was money out of success and enormous deals. He lived as one of those men who was always about to make that big deal, and if that big deal came through, it was all going to be over. He'd pay back all his debts. His children didn't know it. He told his children, don't be afraid of failure, whatever, I can get you through. You want to go to the best colleges? I'll pay for it. You want to do? And so his children began to believe that their dad was really some hot stuff. And then Biff, one of the children, failed in an entrance exam to a prestigious institution, and he didn't know what he was going to do. I know what I'll do. I'll go and talk to my dad. He can get me through. So he goes looking for his dad, and he can't find him. Finally, he tracks him down in a hotel room in Boston, and he keeps knocking and knocking and knocking. He knows his dad is in there, but the dad doesn't open. Finally, the dad lets him in, and the dad looks rather disheveled and flustered to see Biff there, and he's trying to hurry him out of the room. But Biff says, "Dad, I need you. I need you right now. I need to get into this college. You'll help me, won't you?" And the dad finally says, "Sure, we will." And the sounds of guffaws of laughter as they embrace, "I'll talk to the principal. I'll get you in." And as they are laughing, and Biff says, "I knew you could do it, Dad. I knew you could do it." He hears the sound of a shrill, shrieking, derisive laughter coming out of the bathroom attached to his dad's room there. And all of a sudden comes out this woman, scantily clad. And his father was in a compromising situation. And of all things, part of the clothing that had been presented to her was a gift taken that he'd originally given to his own wife. That pivotal moment in the book, Arthur Mailer zeroes in on. And Biff is never able to get that out of his mind when he finds out his father is living a lie. The story goes on, and the last scene is his father cannot accept himself anymore. He knows he's betrayed his children. Pulls out of the driveway, and the book ends with the sound of a crash and the dad's car wrapped around a tree. And these words, as Biff looks at his mom and he says, "Mom, you know what the trouble with Dad was? He never really knew who he was." Secular minds are so sharp sometimes in their focus. He never really knew who he was. And I think what God is saying to Israel is, did you know who you were? And I look at America today, and I wish I could have just a 30-second look at some of the men who are betraying the trust, some of the women who are betraying the trust, and say to them, do you know who you are as a nation? Do you know what God has done for you as a nation over the years so that all roads were leading here? Do you remember the speeches made by men like Abraham Lincoln decades ago, warning us of what would happen if we ever forget who we are? Ancestral disappointments. Secondly, prophetic duplicity. There was a mixed message coming through from the prophets and from the preachers. And again, I want to relate in a kind way here because I can relate as a preacher. I see struggles in my ministry today. I've just celebrated 20 years of preaching ministry. I graduated from my undergrad in 1972, and in 20 years of preaching ministry, I sense temptations now in the ministry that I never sensed when I first began. And I do not mean in any sensuous term. I mean the sense of security temptations, the sense of financial temptations, the sense of bigness temptations. You know what I mean? Because the ministry has changed today. Centuries ago, when you think of people like Henry Martin, who was a Cambridge scholar and went to India and went to Burma and went to Iran, died at the age of 31, but not before he translated the New Testament into Arabic, into Persian, and into Hindustani. At the age of 31, without a computer. Dragged across a desert in chains, gave up the girl he loved because she didn't want to go to the countries he was going to. He gave up the girl he loved in order to go. I think of C.T. Studd, the great cricketer who gave up that brilliant career in cricket and was the captain of the Cambridge University team. I used to go into Trinity Hall many times just because I knew at one time C.T. Studd used to be there. He was a very wealthy man. C.T. Studd gave the money he had, part of it, for the starting of Moody Bible Institute. He gave up all of that and went on to Africa. And because of certain conditions, I don't recall the exact duration, his wife was generating resources in England while he was a missionary in Africa. And I think in the last 11 years, they only saw each other for 2 weeks. I'm not extolling it. I'm not endorsing it. I don't understand it. But we've come a long way from there. That's all I'm trying to say. Today, when a young student graduates from seminary or Bible college, one of his first questions is the benefits he's going to get. And it used to be in times gone by where the minister would get in and first ask, do I have what it takes to make this kind of sacrifice and commitment? Things have changed. Here's my challenge to you. I think it'll be vital in our homes to teach our children and ourselves to pray for our preachers and our pastors and our Christian leaders. That's where the breakup generally begins. I need your prayers more than I need anything else of you. so that God would give wisdom when I am in positions of pivotal decision making. Billy Graham said on an interview across television that the biggest fear he lives with every day when he wakes up, am I going to do something today that'll blow it all for 40 to 50 years of faithfulness? How much Christian leaders need our prayers. There is a prophetic duplicity in the air, forcing us to compromise our convictions. One of the major denominations in the country last year was changing its doctrine. I don't want to name it for you, but you know what I'm talking about if you've read it, and how they were trying to bring these changes of ordaining certain lifestyles and putting them into the ministry. And so ridiculous were the changes that the masses of the people thoroughly voted it down. And I recall being in Toronto buying some books from a woman who was in her very senior years, theological books. This was about 2 to 3 years ago. My father-in-law and I were there buying some books from her because I'd seen it advertised. Fine, classic Christian works. Finally, she said to me, what kind of work are you? And I said, I'm an evangelist. And my father-in-law is really quite the historian in denominational histories. And as we started to talk, this woman belonging to a liberal denomination in Toronto, the largest church in Canada today, said this to both of us, because they have passed the very laws that were rejected here by the major denomination I've referred to. And she looked at me and she said, you know, Mr. Zacharias, when I was a little girl growing up, my mother used to warn me of the influences from outside the church that would take me away. She said, if my mother were alive today, she would not be able to bear the tragedy of what's happened. She said, I never dreamed of the day where it would come, where I would be praying that God would protect me from the decisions of my pastor. Prophetic duplicity, ancestral disappointments, prophetic duplicity. Thirdly and quickly, national desertion. Then came the exchanging of the gods for false gods. Muggeridge knows my Solzhenitsyn very well. He said, Alexander Solzhenitsyn said to me that the response he received at Harvard broke his heart more than all of the years of torture under the Gulag and the communist regime. Do you know that when he spoke at Harvard, they booed him? This Nobel laureate? If you want to get a copy of that address, I'm sure you can. I have several copies of it myself. It's a powerful address called A World Split Apart, and he challenged the Harvard mind to get right with God. And he says this when he received the Templeton Prize for Religion. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, this brilliant mind, says, when I was a little boy running around my house playing, I used to hear my parents and my grandparents sitting and talking at the table, and invariably the question would come up, why has our nation suffered so much? Why has our nation suffered so much? And he said, they used to think I wasn't really listening, but I was listening. Suddenly I'd hear my grandfather say something like this, our nation has suffered much because we have forgotten God. Because we have forgotten God. And he said to that audience, he said, ladies and gentlemen, after all of these decades, after reading thousands of books, after writing thousands of pages, after trying to understand the history of the global scene, I have come to the same conclusion my grandfather came to decades ago. The reason for our misery is because we have forgotten God. And finally, and I'll tell you, I'm swallowing much more than I'm saying here, personal disavowal. Personal disavowal. Then you find yourself sitting next to somebody in the church who once upon a time avowed the name of God, and he looks to you and says, I don't believe it anymore. About 2 months ago, I was speaking at a very fine church in Atlanta. They had given me 3 subjects to speak on. Number 1, does God exist? Number 2, is God good? Number 3, is God fair? Back to back, 3 messages. So I phoned the man who had put those together. I said, how did you arrive at such simple themes for one day? 8:30 a.m., 10:30 a.m., 6 p.m., you know. Does God exist? Is God good? Is God fair? I'd love to design subjects for some people too. You know what he said to me? He said, we have a very strong skeptic in our church. And he was on the planning committee. We invited him to plan this series of meetings. He comes to church, but he doesn't believe. And he said, can I design the subjects for our speaker to speak? And he has given you these 3 subjects. And after the last one, they were going to have an hour of open forum questions. The place was packed. He asked the first question, which I was to find out later. It was him. After the meeting, he comes to me. He says, you've moved me one notch. I used to be an atheist. Tonight, I have become an agnostic. I say, now I don't know. I said, that's a great victory. One new brick is in place. He said, can I talk to you? So the same week he came and had lunch with me, I took him out, a brilliant young computer engineer. And he says to me, he says, Ravi, here's the problem. I used to be a very impassioned believer. And then I started to read. And I began to lose my confidence. The man I admired most was a brilliant intellectual who I admired, and he was a devout Christian. And one day I went to have lunch with him, and I said, I want to be very honest with you and tell you something. Would you please retain the confidence and then help me? He says, I have a very hard time believing that the Bible is really God's word and Jesus is who he claimed to be. He said, and I came for help. He paused and stunned me and said, I'm going through the same problem too. You've come to the wrong man. Personal disavowal. Is there somebody here like that this morning? Where you have come to a point in your life where sitting where you are, you say, in the ruthless honesty of my heart, Ravi, as much as I'm intrigued that all's being said, I really can't buy into this with my life. Portions of it, maybe, I cannot come to the point of whether this God is really who he claimed to be. That's what happened to the nation. And I hope, as an apologist, in some way I can start responding to it before we are through with it all. But we looked this morning very quickly at the process. There was ancestral disappointment, there was prophetic duplicity, there was national desertion, and then there was finally a personal disavowal. I give you two thoughts with which I end here. King George VI inspired the nation of the Commonwealth with his famous Christmas Day address, and I leave that as a positive note on which to close and then make a personal application that helped me, that I trust will help you. He closed his Commonwealth address to the nations that year, not knowing himself that cancer had invaded his body and before long he was going to die. He didn't know it. He said this, I said to the man at the gate of the year, give me a light that I may walk safely into the unknown. I said to the man at the gate of the year, give me a light that I may walk safely into the unknown. And he said to me, put your hand into the hand of God, and it shall be to you better than the light and safer than the known. And he said to me, put your hand in the hand of God, and it shall be to you better than the light and safer than the known. When I was studying philosophy at Cambridge under Don Cupid, a famous philosopher in England, Don Cupid is an ordained Anglican priest and an avowed atheist. He has written a book called The Sea of Faith, and every morning for 2 hours, I would be pummeled by this atheist. About 8 or 10 here in a high level of research. Across the road was Trinity College, where Bertrand Russell had gone and Isaac Newton had taught and Lord Byron, all these halls. And next to that was a church. And he'd go up to the window and point to that church. He said, do you see what those steeples are? He said, once upon a time, that symbolized what we believed. Now it is touristification, heritageization. If anybody comes to England, I tell them, this is what we once used to believe. Brilliant philosopher. And every morning for 2 hours, sitting on the edge of your seat, wondering how you were going to challenge, what was said, what was the best way, what was the most effective way. And I used to begin my day by going for a run around Cambridge, which is like a garden. And I used to think of the beautiful hymns and sing some of them in my own soul as I would run and think of those words. And one of the hymns that I memorized then was by Charles Wesley. And every morning before I walked into these halls, I would mutter the words to myself or as I was running. Charles Wesley wrote this. It has become my own testimony of commitment in my life. He says this, O thou who camest from above, the pure celestial fire to impart, kindle a flame of sacred love on the mean altar of my heart. There let it for thy glory burn with inextinguishable blaze and trembling to its source return in humble prayer and fervent praise. Jesus, confirm my heart's desire to work and speak and think for thee. Still let me guard the holy fire and still stir up thy gift in me. Ready for all thy perfect will, my acts of faith and love repeat till death thy endless mercy seal and make my sacrifice complete.
We hope this message has encouraged you.